Right, now, there was in particular, there's one specific amplitude that we talked about, which is what I will be using, which is the so-called EPRLFK gamma model. And that's this one model that we have written down. In particular, this is very specific. Now, unfortunately, in all physical theories, which have the two following properties, i.e., first of all, you have infinitely many degrees of freedom, and second of all, you have nonlinear dynamics. And most physical theories that are of interest to us are of this case, in particular general relativity is. The theories in question depend on the scale. And that means the physics of the whole situation depends on scale. So what does this mean? This means that these theories behave differently. At different scales. Right, so the example that you probably all know. Before I get to the example. So now what does this mean in most of the theories like lattice quantum chromodynamics or so, is particularly all of these are background dependent. And background dependent theories, this means, first of all, you organize all of your scales of your theory hierarchically along some sort of number. And very often this is, for instance, done in sort in terms of an edge length on a lattice discretization or a maximum energy in quantum field theory. So the organize the scales along very often length parameter. And second of all, well, what does it mean that the theory behaves differently on these different scales? That means, well, the action that describes the dynamics is different. And to describe different actions, use sort of different coupling constants. So you use so-called coupling constants so to speak as coordinates in theory space. What this means is that the action or say the effective path integral action or whatever you have in order to describe something like either dynamics or scattering amplitudes or what have you, depends on certain coupling constants. And if you perform a certain experiment at a certain energy scale, well, there's a certain rule about which value the coupling constants need to have. So now that's the example I wanted to talk about, or what I wanted to give you, for instance. You know, the fine structure constant of the electromagnetic interaction, alpha at room temperature, is about the value that you all know and probably learned in school. It's 1 over 137, whereas at different energies, for instance, at the energy which corresponds to the mass of the Z boson, for instance, which is above is roughly 91 GeV, C squared, 91 GeV. That has a different value. That's 128, so it gets a bit stronger. And the higher the energy, the stronger that number gets. In particular, that is a dimensionless number, so that's actually something which is not just, you know, a redefinition of scales and doesn't really or like length scales, and doesn't just, you know, naively scale with because it's unit dependent, but it's actually something that just changes on different scales. Right. So now, and obviously, there's a physical reason for that, right? That's the physical reason is that the electric interaction between two particles is shielded from each other by virtual electron-positron pairs. And if you bring things closer together, then there's not enough room for electron-positron pairs to be created. So there's less shielding, so the interaction strength gets stronger. So that's words to describe what's behind the mathematics here. Right, now something similar is what we would expect for the quantum gravity theories that we're working on, in particular with the spin foam models. So similarly, for spin foam models, or in general, every theory of quantum gravity. Now, as Wolfgang has already said in his talk, we don't actually have, we can't do this A, because we can't really organize the different scales along this length parameter, because that only works for background dependent theories. You need to have a background metric in order to say how long some distance is. While in general relativity, you would think that the fields themselves just tell you how long something, some distance is or so. So, but you can do something different. In particular, the scales here correspond to the triangulation that you're using, or correspond to the discretization of space-time. Now, obviously, this means that this such a discretization does not come with a length parameter, but nevertheless, you can say, well, I have a very fine discretization, I have a very coarse discretization, and I can try to compare these. Obviously, that's much more difficult to compare than just using one number, but nevertheless, that's something that you can try to do. So for instance, if you have some force simplex, which I can't draw here, because I want to use three-dimensional images. Again, thinking of having one large force simplex. You can also think of some smaller or some finer triangulation consisting of several different force simplices, and so on and so forth here. This is probably something that you have seen before. Now, these are four tetrahedra glued together to form one big tetrahedron. And the idea is just use different amplitudes for this thing, and these things. Simply because this blue triangulation is finer than the white one, so it has information about more continuum degrees of freedom, so the effective dynamics should be different. Is it just those two?
You mean that move?
Yeah?
There's a background.
Oh yeah, that's a background thing. Yeah. Ah, here we go. Right. Oh, wow. Right. So in this talk, by the way, please tell me if my writing is too small or there's something that you can't read. I will talk some general class of models. Ah, sorry, that's something that I want to talk about. Just very, very quickly, before I do this, tell you that, okay, so we want to have different amplitudes here. Now, these amplitudes that have been constructed and also given to you in the last talk, they obviously do depend on some coupling constants, right? So used coupling constants in the construction of the vertex amplitude. So obviously there's Newton's constant in there. It's just that nobody writes this down because they just set it to one. There is the Babarium-Mirzi parameter in there, which people do write down because they don't really know what to do with this, but yet some people like to take a certain limit, some people don't. But it's definitely a coupling constant. Well, that's pretty boring, obviously, but nevertheless, it's there, right? It's just a prefactor, but as soon as you add, for instance, a cosmological constant to that, then you need to distinguish. Well, probably you can just rescale everything by the Newton's constant. I don't know how much sense that would actually make, but anyway. Right, so you can also put in the cosmological constant, which actually requires you to change the definition of what we have seen to be something more elaborate. Right, so there are these coupling constants, but it's not clear to us whether these by themselves are enough. It's not clear to us whether the theories that we have been writing down, whether this functional dependence should only really depend on these three coupling constants. So what I want to do, and that's what I erased here, is talk about a general class of models. And these will be very, very general in the sense that there are lots of coupling constants that you can play around with. So I don't just want to take the, say, EPRL model and just play around with the three parameters that we have, but talk about the general class of models which still have some common features which can, which you can play around with and then look at the class of all of these models and then see whether the renormalization group flow, i.e. the running of these coupling constants, tells you anything interesting about that. And there's two different formulations that I would like to talk about. The first one is the spin foam models, the operator formalism. By the way, the way that these models actually differ from each other are connected to the precise way in which you try to implement the simplicity constraints. And since we don't really know for 100% that the way that we did it is the right one, it's probably nice to have just a more general way of doing this. Okay, so in the EPRL model, and I will talk about Riemannian signature here, what you have is, I already told you this, you have a 4D triangulation. So you have four simplices, two four simplices are glued together along a tetrahedron, several tetrahedra are glued together along a triangle, and then there's lower dimensional simplices down there. Here you have the dual triangulation, where this is dual to something that's called a vertex, which is also a point just like this one, but please don't confuse it. Whenever two vertices are connected, they are connected by something that's called an edge, and the boundary, these edges form the boundary of faces. So you can see that the dimension of this plus the dimension of this always adds up to 4. And there, you know, theoretically there are more of these, but in fact we only need those. Okay, in particular we don't want to use triangulations, but we want to have some more general arrangements of these. And that's called a two-complex. Now this two-complex is something that you have already seen in the last talk. It was this colored image by Wolfgang, which depicted, so to speak, a transition of a spin network over time so that it, you know, swiped out something two-dimensional. Sorry, you had a question?
Yeah, just for clarification. So the four simplices are glued together at the three simplices?
Yes.
Is it fixed how many four simplices share a three simplex?
Yeah, two.
There's always two. And then
yes.
At the triangles?
No, at the triangle, that's not really okay. Fixed, right. But you know, in every triangulation of an n-dimensional manifold, two n simplices are always glued together along an n-1 simplex. And that's what we have in mind here.
Yeah, I was just trying to make sense of it because, you know, in 2D, the dynamical triangulations, you have the meeting at the vertices, and you have several triangles at one vertex, while in regular calculus, you have always six at one vertex. And I was wondering if something similar happens, well, I think something similar happens in higher dimensions, and then in which class the spin firms.
Sorry, what did you say in regular calculus? What number was fixed?
In
regular calculus,
you can choose one triangulation, but you can choose an arbitrary triangulation.
Oh, okay, then I have misunderstood that.
Yeah, so you, then what you're saying is that you fix the regular triangulation, but there's no need to do that.
No, but I always thought in regular calculus you have some numbers, the edge lengths, which means
yes.
That you can fix the number of triangles at one point, but still have non-trivial deficit angle.
Yeah. You can fix. You can choose.
You can choose whatever
particular triangulation.
Okay.
But you can choose whatever triangulation. And indeed, it's an important question what you do with this. What does this talk about?
Right. So here, I mean, in this image, this face has six vertices around it. But that's just because people like to draw hexagons. I mean, in general, it could be as many as you like. Right, so this two-complex is, well, what you would expect. It's something where you glue together faces, edges, and vertices to form something which is more general and which looks like, well, lots of soap bubbles. Or like thin soap films filling out this kind of one-dimensional lattice, which is why people have also coined the term spin firms. But you're right. So everything that we are going to do here is choose one particular two-complex. And we set this up because later on, which is not what we're going to do in this talk, but later on one would like to ask the question, well, how do we have to change this theory if we change this two complex? And in order to be able to change the theory in many different important ways, that's we introduce this large class of models where we have lots of parameters to play with. Right, in particular, this two complex is oriented. That means that the edges come with an orientation and the faces also come with an orientation. And we say that E, F is 1 if the relative orientation agrees, and E, F is minus 1 if the relative orientation does not agree. Okay, so how does such a two complex look like locally? Well, it consists of edges, and edges have faces meeting at that edge. And there can be an arbitrary number of them. So, so this is E, and there's lots of faces around that. Face 1, face 2, and so on until Fn.
But in the case of the triangulation, there will be...
That's precisely correct. If you don't use an arbitrary two-complex, but if you use the two-complex which you get if you start out with a four-dimensional triangulation, then, simply because each tetrahedron has four triangles, n will always be 4. But now we're doing something more general. We are just taking some two-complex which is not necessarily dual to a triangulation, but, well, that means you can have arbitrary many faces meeting at one edge. Right. And for this very important construct is the so-called Edge-Hilbert space. Now, I already said that, you know, we talked about the EPIL model and, in particular, the Riemannian one. And something that you have already seen very much in the last talk was the advent of so-called spins. Here we want to have something slightly more general. We don't want to look at just general relativity, but we want to look at all kinds of models. So the gauge group is left to be arbitrary. It's just cheap. The only thing that we demand is that it's a compact Lie group. In particular, that means that it has irreducible representations, which we call rho, in what follows. Right, and now we can introduce the Edge-Hilbert space. So there's one for each edge. And this is the tensor product of... how did I write this here? About all faces where the relative orientation agrees, and you take the finite dimensional unitary irreducible representation space. So this is the finite dimensional irreducible unitary representation space for some rho belonging to this face F, and you have the tensor product where the same thing is being done for the minus 1, for where all the orientations do not agree. It's just that you take the dual space. So that's the dual one. So obviously, this Hilbert space depends on an assignment of lots of irreducible representations along the faces.
Excuse me?
Yes?
So can I understand this generalized two complex as the edge still can dual to a tetrahedron and the face can still be dual to a triangle, but the vertex is not dual to a force field?
No, the edge is dual to not a tetrahedron, but to a polyhedron with several more faces. And then, well, the four-dimensional vertex is dual, you can think of this as being dual to some larger polyhedron in four-dimensional space where the faces are not tetrahedra, but these generalized three-dimensional polyhedra. Right. Now, for a model, we choose an operator, and this is the so-called edge operator, PE, which maps the Hilbert space to itself. And if you come from lattice gauge theory, you can think of this as the transfer matrix. All right. So now what do we have? We have, first of all, we have a distribution of irreducible representation rho f among the faces. So we just choose some. And then we also choose these operators, any linear operators. Okay, so what I'm telling you now is that you can take arbitrary choice of these and produce a very nice number. And that is this generalized spin from amplitude for the whole triangle or for the whole two complex.
So that's a data PE.
Sorry?
PE for the choice of operators.
Yes.
For non-primary.
Yeah, in fact, there's even a bit more choice, which I would write down now. Obviously, I will tell you what interesting choices for these PEs are, so that you get back, for instance, the spin foam model that we talked about in the last session, but you also get, for instance, the Barrett-Crane model, or you get the, or you get lattice gauge theory, or you get the F theory, whatever you want. It's different choices for these PE. Okay, so now we need to talk about the vertex trace. I told you how this two complex looks like around an edge. There's lots of faces meeting around an edge. How does it look like around a vertex? Well, if you have a vertex somewhere, there's lots of edges meeting at that vertex. And between some of these edges, there will be faces. So now here I've drawn it in a very, very much simplified manner. But in general, you can have something. Well, you can have something more general. So this is a vertex V. This is E1. This is E2. And say this is a face. This is the face between E1 and E2. So this face is part. So this thing is part of a larger face where we've drawn just a little bit. Right. So now let's look at these operators. TE1, these operators, because they map these Hilbert spaces, where this Hilbert space is supposed to be at the starting point, the starting vertex of E, and this one is supposed to sit at the ending vertex of E. PE1 has lots of indices. So let's say we have something like this. So PE1 has lots of indices. In particular, there's one index that belongs to the face F. And this face F, in this particular case, sorry, let's take this the other way around so it's a bit easier. If you go through the mathematics, you can see that this index is somewhere up here, where indices in the vector space in the representation are upstairs, and indices in the dual representations are downstairs. Now, there's lots of other indices. There's indices down here. But the very important point is that PE2, which also has lots of indices, has one index with respect to F. And the choices for the orientation are made in such a way that it's in a different position. Right. So now, when we write these two operators next to each other, what we can do naturally is we can contract them. with, for instance, with a delta in FMF. Now, if you wanted to have even more general class of models, say, for instance, some with an introduction of a cosmological constant, or some where this secondary simplicity constraint that Wolfgang talked about in the very end of the last lecture should be imposed, then you wouldn't take a delta function here. You would take something maybe slightly more enhanced. But here, taking this delta function is something very easy, and it's basically what we talked about in the last lecture is that the dynamics in the middle of this four-dimensional piece of space-time is basically just the F theory. Okay, that's just a side comment. Right, and then, must have been a strange echo. We have another choice of so-called phase amplitudes. These are coefficients which depend on irreducible representations. All right, now that we've made lots and lots of choices, I tell you how to actually produce a number out of that, and this number is supposed to have an interpretation as the path integral of our theory. So the state sum z equals, well, for this choice of these operators, first of all, for a specific choice of these irreducible representations, you just take the product. And at each vertex, what you do is you form the vertex trace with respect to all faces of all the edge operators that arrive at this vertex.
The vertex trace, I infinity.
Say again?
You say that I infinity assigning the vertex trace. You say that you can contract indices by there?
Yes.
For each edge, does it appear always twice in a vertex? Or each edge is shared by more faces? How many faces touch a given edge?
Well, one particular edge can be attached by many faces.
Many faces?
Yes.
Yes, and then
like over here.
Yeah, but then in this trace, if I contract everything, are there some, how am I sure that I don't have any indices flying around?
You want to know why you can contract this image. So you have to show that the face appears twice for every edge. Each face
oh,
has
yes.
an index.
Yeah, that's right. So that's the way these two complexes are built up upon. So in particular, each face looks like this, where all of these vertices are different. So if you have a more general CW complex, obviously what you can do is you can glue things together in a weird way. But here what we want to have is that all of these vertices are different. And if you have that, that means that this face is different from all the other faces here in my image. And you have one edge running into this vertex and one edge running out of that vertex. And if, for instance, we talk about this vertex, it's these two edges.
Okay.
So if you go through this construction, in particular about the orientation, it's not too hard to convince yourself that it's made exactly in such a way that, in particular, these appear on opposite sides. Which means that there's a natural way to contract them.
So you have two P's per edge or one P per edge?
I have one P per edge.
But then don't you need to split them?
No.
One P per half edge, which contracts to the vertex amplitude?
No, P is an operator from the Hilbert space to itself. So P has... So P has two indices belonging to that edge. One is at the beginning of this Hilbert space, and one is in the end of that Hilbert space. Now here, because V is the beginning of E1, we take the index that's at the beginning. And here, V is the end of E2, so that's we take the index which is at the end.
But what do we do with the index which is at the end?
Yeah.
Say again? Oh, that's being contracted at a different vertex.
Yeah, that was my question. When we have two p's per edge and one p per half edge,
no. I mean, this doesn't factorize, right? I mean, the way that I've written it down here is a bit misleading. You're perfectly right.
So yes,
that's not yet the vertex amplitude. So what you do is you write down all the p's for all the edges of the sole two-dimensional, of the sole two-complex. And then for every vertex, there's lots of indices which fit together, so you contract them.
Okay, so this is a phase, it's not for single
vertices. Right, so it's not really for a...
Usually we don't call it a trace. We say we have a product of intertwiners.
Yes.
And then we have an isomorphism between the tensor product of vertex with these double things, and then we have a pairing between these two states.
Right. So I will write down ways in which you can write down these PEs in terms, in particular in terms of these intertwiners and boundary Hilbert spaces in a second.
I'm thinking about the trace is the intertwiner. The PEs, you don't have to touch them.
No, the trace is basically this contraction. That's what it's being called, for instance, in the paper by the Warsaw group.
Yeah, but that's not the trace. I'm sorry. You have an intertwiner, and then you contract that, and you get some bigger object.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I think it's, I don't know.
It's tracing out over those two.
I know. The Warsaw group came, you know, mm-hmm. 15 years after everything was mm-hmm. set up, you know, to describe spin form. So, the proper way to describe how it comes with spin form, it doesn't necessarily come from there.
No, it's just a name that people use, in particular because it's a partial trace of this huge
the
operator.
The name that people used before was intertwiner, right? And then the thing is that you have an isomorphism between the tensor product. So each vertex has a Hilbert space, right? Associated with the tensor product of the incoming or outgoing Hilbert spaces. And then you have an isomorphism between the tensor product of all these Hilbert spaces with the tensor product of all these endomorphisms.
Here there are no intertwiners.
Yeah.
That's more general. There are no intertwiners yet. There are no intertwiners yet.
It doesn't matter if there are intertwiners. These contractions here,
Can we call the trace V Warsaw trace and go on?
It's not a trace. It's just not a trace.
Yeah, it's just...
It's a pairing. It's not a pairing.
All right. Now, this is something that you can do for a specific distribution of irreducible representations along the faces of the two complex, and then you sum over all of them. Right. So that's a number. Well, as I said, the basic choices that we have made here are, as I said, and I write it down again, are these face amplitudes. And which are the edge operators. Right, and if you have the more traditional way of writing down the spin form models in mind, then actually these are the phase amplitudes that you think of. And here in these operators, there are hidden the vertex and the edge amplitudes.
Trace is
one of the choices, so yes. The fact that you choose the delta function here, you're absolutely right. Here in everything that I do, I will always stick to this delta. You can make things even more general, and as we have discussed about, that's maybe a good idea to do. But here I really want to talk about the generalization in these two directions.
And just to finish
there would be other choices which are still compatible with fetch invariants.
Sorry, say again?
So one could use other contractions that are still consistent with fetch invariants and the vertex.
Oh yes, definitely. Say again?
It's not a quartet.
Yeah, it's just
tearing the the way you write it, it looks like it's a product of a local product. That's where I mean, you know, you should revert to what happened before the Barcel group, which was the proper way of writing this, which is the way people did it.
All right. Just for you, I will write down the new way of notation. So in general, first of all, I would like to talk about certain properties of Z, depending on what kind of choices you make for the PE. Here, first of all, you could say, well, we take arbitrary operators, and this number makes sense for arbitrary operators. But that might be a bit too general. There are some things that you might demand of Z. And the first of all is you might demand that PE is Hermitian. And that might be desirable because that means that the value of Z does not depend on the chosen orientations. You remember that we had an orientation on the edges and the faces, and that orientation featured heavily in our description. But if you choose the PE to be Hermitian, then, well, it's just some structure that you have to introduce once in order to do calculations, and then you can forget about it. The second of all, something that you might want to have or might not, is the fact that you can that the square of P is the same as P. And if you have that, then Z is invariant under trivial subdivision of edges. Which means that if you take the same two complex, but now you take one edge and subdivide it by one vertex, and you leave everything else unchanged, then this Z doesn't change. And the last thing, which is the most important one, and this is where we come to talk about intertwiners, actually, and that's something that we most likely all want to have, is the following, is that PE commutes with the gauge action. And that means that, in particular, the Z is what's called gauge invariant. Or is the state sum for a gauge invariant theory, to be more precise?
Isn't it even stronger that GPE equals P? Because the initial and final point are.
No, that's fine. This PE needs to be the high intertwiner. So that is actually, that's enough. Right. Yeah. Right. So in general, what is the general form that these edge operators can actually have? Now what I want to do is, well, remember V1 tensor, V2 tensor, and so on, tensor VK plus 1 dual, and so on, until the last one. So that's our Hilbert space. And the invariant Hilbert space of each E2 is the set of invariant G invariant elements. And these are also called intertwiners. Okay, and in general, sorry, I already had that. This, in general, for any PE satisfying the gauge invariance and this Hermitian thing, PE is a sum over an orthonormal basis in this invariant Hilbert space. So this is sum over an orthonormal basis in this invariant Hilbert space. But these are just coefficients. And obviously they are just IM, PE, IN. Right, and I would say it again that in spin film models, the precise choice of these P and M are the choice of implementation of the centricity constraints. All right, so now that we have that.
So,
yes?
So, E sub M is an intertwiner. So, you're summing over.
Yes, these iota N are, these label an orthonormal basis in the intertwiner space. You're right. Okay, now this is still fairly general. And now I will just tell you about certain choices that you can make in these omega hats and these p's so that you get certain theories that you might know. So what do you do in order to get BF theory? You choose omega hat to be the dimension of rho, the dimension of the representation space, and you choose the P and M just as the delta and M. In particular, that means this is the so-called Haar intertwiner. P, and I will just write this as P har. This is a very specific P that people like to use. You can take lattice gauge theory. And with that, I mean pure lattice gauge theory without any fermions, where the group that you want to take is probably SUN or what have you. Here again, the P and M is delta and M, but the omegas look slightly different. The omega hats are the dimension of rho, but there's an additional factor, and this additional factor is e to the minus. Here you have an A over AF over G squared, and here you have lambda rho F, where G is the Tuft coupling, AF is the area of the face, F. Now, suddenly, in order to be able to write something down like this, you need a background metric, which is the reason why, in order to write down lattice gauge theory on a manifold, you need to write down lattice gauge theory on a manifold with a metric. Otherwise, you don't know how to write this down. You need a background structure. And this lambda rho F is the eigenvalue of minus the Laplace operator on the group of the character. So this is lambda rho. So where this is the character of G belonging to rho, and this is the Laplace operator on G. So the characters are eigenvectors of the Laplace operators, and the eigenvalue is the one that you put here. Now there's more possibilities. The so-called Barrett-Crane model. Here in particular, you take G to be the product of some H cross H. So this is a pair of two other Lie groups, which is still a compact Lie group. Omega, now this rho 1, rho 2 is the dimension of rho 1 times the dimension of rho 2 times delta of rho 1, rho 2. And P NM is delta NM delta, sorry, it's delta NM if IN is the so-called Barrett-Crane intertwiner and it's zero else. The last thing I want to write down is the EPIL model in this context. The EPIL FK model. Now, as I said, this comes with as a parameter, which I now take to be between 0 and 1. G is SU2 cross SU2. So these rho Fs, what they actually are, they are a pair of spins. These spins being irreducible representations of these SU2s. And omega J plus J minus hat is, well, there's two possibilities. again there's 2j plus plus 1, 2j minus plus 1, if a certain condition holds, and this condition is that 2j plus over 1 plus gamma is the same as 2j minus over 1 minus gamma, and that's the same as some k, which is a half integer spin. So this is supposed to be an element in, it's just turned around, and it's zero else. And I will write you down the EPRLFK projector. This is a sum. Now this sum is a sum over an orthonormal basis, not in the invariant Hilbert space of the edges, but in the invariant Hilbert space of these K of the invariant Hilbert space. Now this is just for SU2 and not SU2 cross SU2 tensor and so on and so forth. So you take these SU2 intertwiners you put on something that's called a boosting map, which in Wolfgang's talk has been denoted by so-called epsilon, and then again, and then you take the SU2 cross SU2 ha intertwiner here and here as well. So this condition actually tells you that each KF is JF plus plus JF minus. So I will not give you the formula for this y. It's a bit involved, but nevertheless, you can do that. Okay, so here you actually have a sum over SU2 intertwiners. Now, if you would like to write this down in terms of these P, it's a bit more involved, but nevertheless, you can do this. Right, so to summarize all of this, so, if you like, you have a generalized spin foam models . So what you need to do is you have need to have a choice of edge amplitudes. And you need to make a choice of which intertwiners you want to sum over. So in particular, this is so which of that means that if these Pn are zero for some, then these intertwiners don't appear. And that is precisely where, as I said already, how in the usual spin foam models for quantum gravity, you impose the simplicity constraints. These simplicity constraints just means that, well, certain intertwiners are not allowed. Only those intertwiners are allowed which have a specific interpretation. And those are the ones that turn up here. Whereas if you don't constrict the sum and just sum over the delta functions, you get BF theory, which tells you very nicely how the spin foam model for general relativity is actually a constrained version of BF theory. All right. There's a different way of writing all this down in terms of group elements, which I will not do right now because I've already talked for quite some time. We can talk about this later if you ask me directly. There's a dual way of writing all of these down in terms of integration over group variables. That formula for the EPRL model is in particular one that you have seen in the talk by Wolfgang. But there's basically just by using the Peter Weil theorem, which is telling you something about the Fourier transform on compact Lie groups. And then everything, this whole formula for Z turns, instead of a sum over irreducible representations and maybe intertwiners, and turns into an integration over group variables. That's something that you can do. And in particular, if you do that, then you see why you can, for instance, show why for these specific choices that I've made, you really get lattice gauge theory back. Well, that's not something that I will do now because I think I'm out of time. Okay, maybe I'll just leave it here and let you all go to lunch. Okay, we already had quite some questions, but go ahead.
Yeah, I just wanted to write. You started with this thing about the coupling constants that we usually carry in field theories, and then you said, I'm going to give you a place where you have a bunch of ability to have coupling constants, and you just say where exactly?
Yes, the coupling constants are, well, normally the coupling constants in, say, a quantum field theory are prefactors in front of interaction terms. Now, in our formula here, now in the spin form formula, it's not so easy to write that down, but what these actually are coordinates in theory space. So that's what different coupling constants do. They parameterize lots of different actions, and for different values, you get different actions. Here, the different coupling constants are different choices of either these edge amplitudes, omega hat, or the choices for what form these PEs specifically take.
There's this very heuristic, probably wrong argument that if you write the Lebesgue action, it comes in the form of plus Lagrange multipliers and just a constant. And for instance, Kirill has put like replace this term by, for instance, some potential of the simplicity constant. And so the potential is also like lots, in principle, you know, lots of coordinates. Because it's a function of lots of implementation, a complicated function. Hmm. So roughly, you can speculate whether there would be a connection between flowing in this kind of potential term and implementation of
what is the key? But I don't think the advantage of this formalism versus the other formalism, the original spin form, where people would say that the amplitude itself for each vertex was that, not the theory space was parameterized by these vertex amplitudes.
Yeah, I mean, there's, if you just say, well, I just take an arbitrary function of the amplitudes, then you're restricting yourself very little, actually. Whereas this gives you only a specific set for amplitudes, a specific way to construct these amplitudes. So this gives you a much smaller set of coupling constants. So one example for this, as I've already told you, for instance, where you can see the coupling constants from normal theories is in the example of lattice gauge theory, where the Tuft coupling appeared here. Mm-hmm. Or another example is this choice of the EPRL intertwiner, which I haven't specifically written down in terms of these P and M, because they are quite complicated. In particular, they are not diagonal in the NM. But these things here depend on gamma. So changing gamma is a way of parameterizing different sets of these peaks.
So yeah, maybe really if you just, for instance, look at all possible logic amplitudes, it's a huge space
yeah.
of possibilities. And if you want to do anything practical, the problem is, you know, to find the subset in this huge space, which could be potentially interesting. That's kind of one question. Another question is, assume you take the vertex amplitudes and do some simple coarse graining, then you get, and there's one move that you stay in terms of vertex amplitudes. But then the question is, can you rewrite this vertex amplitude into a form which looks again like a scale theory?
So another way of saying this is that if you take just an arbitrary amplitude function, you just have an arbitrary function. And obviously that's a, as Bianca said, a huge space of models. All the models that you can construct from here, all are very similar to the spinform models in the following sense. They can be viewed as, first of all, they can be viewed as generalized lattice gauge theories. And second of all, they are all in one sense or the other constrained BF theories. Where, well, if you choose these omegas correctly, if you choose these omegas arbitrary, then it's a constrained Young-Mills theory, if you like. So that's the realm of theories where you can work, so to speak. So the choice of these P's is a choice of how to impose the simplicity constraints.
But yeah, no, it's an important question, but it's deep. The question is, what is the space of models we should look at? And one possibility is you look at all the vertex amplitudes. If you count the dimensions, it's already huge for, I don't know, small groups. I don't know, we counted it for SC once.
Yeah, that's for S3 in three dimensions, that's not too bad. That's just 11.
No, but
or so.
It was in four dimensions, it was 211.
Oh, yeah, and in four dimensions, like 200 and something. So if you just say, well, take arbitrary functions, then you already have too many.
But the only space is supposed to be infinite dimensions.
No.
I mean, this works for finite groups.
For in general, it's infinite dimensional. But the statement, the question is, if you want to set up something like a useful calculation and a useful truncation, then the starting point, the starting point is basically which kind of series do you look at? And you cannot look at all of them. You have to choose an initial parameterization. And the second question is what kind of truncation you choose in projecting back at each step to which kind of series. Mm-hmm. And it's something which the dynamics has to decide, and we usually guess. And so here it's basically, okay, how can we still speak of simplicity constraints, but somehow enlarge the space so that it's useful to look at some set of initial models which still have an interpretation of simplicity constraints?
So for instance, in this formulation, what you could ask yourself is, a sensible question to ask and maybe even to answer is, how do the simplicity constraints flow along the RG trajectory? Whereas so this is just one way of parameterizing some part of this, as you rightfully said, infinite dimensional theory space. I mean, if you're honest, then this still gives you some infinite dimensional space. But nevertheless.
But the flow will put you out of it. I mean, this is what linking and undulation calculated. If you look at the simplest flow, you can't rewrite the flow and amplitude after you cross grain in terms of a given projector. You might.
The reason for that is that these are, in particular, by construction, local, you're right. I mean,
yeah.
All of these are also done in a way so that they are very, very local.
So
and if you do renormalization in position space, you're right. You construct non-local terms.
The flow you also
yeah. What they showed, though, is that, in fact, it seems to be a good for the very particular flow we look at. It's very simple. Is that this was a good opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
So the dominant term is always the one which reprojects onto the projector. But there is a huge hypothesis, right? Usually, this is why in field theory we use the local basis, because then you have a theorem that says that this is the basis which is stable in the RG flow. So here, it's this choice of projector is natural and it's chosen for simplicity. But there's a huge, but it's a mathematical simplicity. It's not yet a physical simplicity. And the challenge is a essentially to show that this ansatz, or this guess, it's an intuition that this is the proper way to look at a subset of theories. It's been formed that this is really the one which, you know, contains the attractor.
Well, we have, like, in the work with Bianca, Wojtek, and Frank, we've looked at, already a couple of years ago, looked at something where we, like in three dimensions, for instance, where you can see that, where we parameterize these and into a few coupling constants, and then the whole flow was something very large dimensional, but projecting back, actually, you could concentrate on something which is basically three dimensional and never made any large mistakes about this. And there you could actually define a very nice flow. So you're right, obviously, that's not something, that's not a proof that that is giving you the correct, in particular, the correct stable set of models that is invariant under RG flow. If we knew what that was, then we would have shown in which way GR is renormalizable.
But it seems, which it we seems have. That there is, you know, it's more stable than you would, because I believe it's completely arbitrary, I guess, but you're right, there's indication that it's kind of stable.
Right.
Okay, so that's, that seems to be a semi-good guess, but that, the crux is really, to understand to what extent this is really...
Yeah, and one important thing is, in fact, locality. So
yeah, why locality? Yes, exactly.
In particular, you're right. Now you can rewrite all of this in terms of vertex amplitudes, which really factorize over all the vertices, in particular by setting these things apart. Then you have to take the square root of these p's, but that doesn't really matter. That's just numbers. And that obviously gives you something very local. And it's not at all clear why this should always be the case. In particular, most likely the RG flow wouldn't stay local. But in those regions where locality is a good approximation, you would expect this to be a good space of functions to look at. All right, are there more questions?
So you were just talking about how there's a very large dimensional coupling space, a very many choices you can make.
Yes.
But I don't know, has anybody looked if there's something like universality happening in some sense? I mean, the simplest example is in matrix models, where it doesn't really matter if you do triangulations or quadrangulations or pentagonations or whatever, and all these choices effectively lead to the same theory. So couldn't it be that maybe you can simplify what polyhedral complexes you take into account and should still lead universally to the same result and in that sense make your life easier?
Yeah, obviously. I mean, this is something that one would expect and hope. On the technical level, that's not something that has been done universality for all the spin foam models, obviously not. But in examples, you can actually see something like that showing up, as we already discussed partially right now. But that's also one of the reasons why, for instance, it would be good to just look at, you know, very specific sets of two complexes like hypercubic lattices or so, as we've done with Sebastian. So, because you expect that a lot of the physics is already contained in there, simply because, you know, when you flow to the right fixed point, which also needs to exist for hypercubical lattices, obviously, then you are already at a point where it doesn't really matter what kind of two complex you take. But obviously, yeah, that's, I mean, no, nobody has shown universality in the sense of a mathematical theorem for this. That would have been nice.
So the, for the, you mentioned the projector property of P.
Yes.
So for the weather plane, is a projector?
Yes, I think for the Barrett-Crane model, it's just, it's really just the projector onto this one-dimensional subspace of the Barrett-Crane intertwiner, which I haven't written down. It's much easier to write down in the holonomy formulation, but here it's a bit nasty.
For the EKL, it's not a projector.
Yes, that's right. It's not a projector, and that has to do with the fact that these PN, that can't really be diagonalized, so it's nicely.
Yeah, so this is actually an example that if you want to make it into a projector, you cannot write it in a local way, or nobody has done it.
I don't understand what you mean. It can't be written in a local way. Yes, of course, you can change this. Now, you can change this formula in order to be a projector by, putting different, something like this or so. like putting different indices here. And Wojciech Kaminski has, so this is just a different number, but choosing different coefficients here. Wojciech Kaminski has calculated these. And that way you can make it through projector. It's just that that's not the EPL model anymore.
Yeah, because you mentioned that TNM is more diagonalizable and more included on the projector.
No, I mean, but I mean, if this is a projector, then this PNM has a very simple form, uh-huh. Right? What I wanted to say is that for the EPL model, it doesn't have any simple form, which is why I haven't written it down in PNM, but I have written it down in this way. That's all I want to say. Okay, but that's not the, that's the EPL model.
So when you provide it, you have to take another basis in which it is diagonal.
Yes, that's right.
And
right, and the reason for that is that these y's together with this projection are not isometries. So you sum over an orthonormal basis in the SU2 intertwiners, and that is an SO4 intertwiner. But if you sum over an orthonormal basis here, you don't get an orthonormal basis in the whole four-dimensional space. That's just how the EPL model is built. Are there any more questions? Well, if not, then have a nice lunch.